everybody. Welcome to another episode of KLCC's Northwest Passage. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
I'm the host of Morning Edition, Ani Katz.
I'm news reporter Brian Bull.
And I'm news reporter Chris Lehman.
So we have a lot to talk about this week, and we'll get to it right away with some of the top stories we've had on KLCC this week. Ani?
Hi. So I've actually been on vacation for a couple weeks. So this was a little challenging for me, but it was actually a good way to, kind of catch up on news over the last few weeks because I wasn't in Oregon. So I kind of paid some extra attention this morning and skimmed through and found some stories that stuck out to me that happened actually just this week. This is actually super interesting to me as a mom because I don't wear glasses, but my husband does, and basically all of our extended families do. So I'm always watching my kids for squinting at the board or having headaches. And now we have the news this week that 270 Oregon kids are going to get comprehensive vision screening in public school districts and preschools, which is interesting. Back in 2017, lawmakers passed a bill to provide $1 million for student vision screenings, and now the funding has been doubled to $2 million thanks to the passage of HB 5015. This comment from Doug Thompson, executive director of the Oregon Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation, really grabbed my ear. He says they believe the state's low graduation rate, we're actually in the bottom five, may be due to undetected vision problems.
This funding will help identify more students that need eyeglasses. As a result, more kids will be able to read at grade level, and we believe that will help them continue on a path of academic success.
Some more news that actually I think this was at the end of last week, all 122 of Eugene 4J School District's older diesel school buses have been replaced with new low emission models. And this news is actually strangely related to Volkswagen's misleading information about their diesel emissions. You remember this story from a few years ago?
It was a huge scandal.
It was
a huge scandal.
Yeah. So apparently states across the country are getting money from the company as part of a financial settlement. It's called the Clean Diesel Engine Fund. Oregon is receiving $72.9 million of the $3 billion spread across the country. Eugene isn't the only place to get new buses. The State Department of Environmental Quality plans to replace at least 450 buses across Oregon. And the diesel, the reason that they're replacing these buses is because there's like this fine particulate in the diesel emissions that is dangerous for the air we breathe. So they're getting rid of it, which is kind of cool news to start the school year with. But we're not talking about the beginning of the school year yet. I'm not ready yet.
Yeah, still
summer.
Still early summer.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't let my kids hear that.
Yeah, I know. Seriously, me too. And speaking of summer, even though it's been rainy and there's more rain in the forecast through Wednesday night, I believe. Fire season for the Pacific Northwest is still in effect. That's just a reminder to everybody because I think we're all kind of wearing pants and long sleeves today and thinking like, oh, it's basically October. But the fire danger level does remain near normal for early July, but there's still definite risk for the region. Here's Carol Connolly with the Northwest Interagency Coordination Center. She says currently the areas most at risk are east of the Cascades due to lightning in the area.
But as we look forward to July, August, and September, our fire weather forecasters are indicating that we still will have an active fire season.
So just this Sunday, as a reminder that it is still dangerous, it can be dangerous outside, fire crews were able to quickly contain and snuff out a fire at the Roseburg landfill. The fire was reported by multiple passersby on I-5, seeing black smoke coming from the area behind the dump. Firefighters kept the blaze to under a quarter acre, and they were able to put it out. But, you know, it's early July. We still have a few months to go of, like, that super high, hot, dry fire season.
And I did hear in that story regarding fire season that really they're looking to August, September
exactly
as the height of fire season, at least for Western Oregon.
Exactly. Yeah. So don't get too comfy in your long sleeves. It's going to get hot again. And actually, if anybody's been paying attention to news very far north of here, Alaska has basically been under a blanket of smoke for the past, I think, week or two because of forest fires that are already starting up there. So they'll make their way down to us, sadly.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Well, Brian, you talked this week with the Eugene Police Auditor, Mark Gissner. He's delivering a report to the police commission this week. What are some of the highlights?
Well, the annual police auditor's report is out. It will be formally presented to the Eugene Police Commission. And Mark Gissner, who's our neighbor, by the way, here at KLCC, has co-authored this report that looks at a number of things, primarily complaints about how Eugene police officers do their jobs. And the most immediate findings that we have is that there were 392 complaints filed against Eugene police in 2018. That's about 20% up from the previous year. And so a lot of people may read into that, are Eugene police acting out of line more, or is there a breakdown of command? There's been a switchover in who's chief of police. But when I put the question to Mark to kind of explain that increase, he said, really, it may be a number of things, such as increased police presence, the number of ambassadors to the downtown area, therefore more interactions with the public. And also, he pointed out to a 2017 finding that the EPD itself had addressed, that there was about a third of calls that Eugene police were not responding to.
And it's just my opinion. Subconsciously, the officers are trying to be faster in providing services, and maybe that translates to some people into impatience or officers being too restrictive in their conversations.
There are some very notable complaints, though. There was an officer who was accused of having sex while on duty, and another one was accused of talking poorly of his coworkers and using very rude and quote-unquote profane language in the workplace. And so those were being investigated and addressed, and both of those officers have since resigned from the EPD. A couple other things, walk-in complaints. I mentioned that Mark Gissner and the auditor's office is right next door to KLCC, so we could even just watch if we wanted to. Walk-in complaints have increased 230%. And part of that may be signage. It's got a very prominent sign on the door and on the upper awning of the building. It's bilingual, English and Spanish, so people have ready access to it. They can do a walk-in and just get whatever's on their mind off their chest and present that to the Eugene police auditor. He also attributes the greater number of walk-in complaints to just the increased number of police in the downtown area. And then finally, Gissner also points to body cams. It was just over 2 years ago that body cams were implemented with the Eugene Police Force, and this allows his office to investigate claims of misconduct. He gets to review the video to see if they're, if the events have rolled out the way that people describe, and it's come in very, very handy to verify accounts. One of the more, high-profile examples would have been back in January with the shooting of Charles Landeros outside the Cascade Middle School. There were a number of accounts about what exactly had transpired between Landeros and two Eugene police officers responding to a custody dispute, and the footage pretty much showed that the officers had acted in accordance and were cleared of a lot of, I would say, claims made by a number of people that they had not acted appropriately. So the body cams seem to be wearing out, and the police auditor is praising their efficiency.
And Brian, you, speaking of the Eugene police, your two-part series on CAHOOTS aired on KLCC last week, and that was a pretty big project that you did. It took you quite a while to put that together, and it came out great. Can you talk a little bit about the process?
Yeah, it took a long time because I was trying to find sources who were able to talk to me about their experiences directly with CAHOOTS. I was very happy to have been given a six-hour ride-along one night back in February. So I got to join Kimber Haas and Daniel Feltz, two CAHOOTS response workers, as we just responded to about a dozen calls in a six-hour shift all across the Eugene-Springfield area. And part of that interaction involved just kind of learning what they do on a day-to-day basis. Here's Daniel Feltz talking about just some of the hazards they see on a regular basis. We were driving by a patch early on in the shift, and here he is just describing kind of what they're assigned to do.
So Brian, this little spot off to the right is a place we colloquially refer to as the Devil's Hole. one of the more common sites for requests that we get from police to pick up dirty needles.
So there's a lot of interaction with people who may not be in their completely best state of mind. They may be having a mental breakdown. They may be having a psychotic episode. They may be tripping out on drugs. There's a number of things that they are trained to do, arguably better than police, because police really want to just focus on crimes like robberies, burglaries, traffic infractions, anything along those lines. Mental health issues are kind of the situations where CAHOOTS workers are really specialized in. And so sometimes they have to really interact and be extremely patient. They also do not carry weapons, by the way, or restraints, so they have to be careful. The Eugene police are on hand to assist if a situation should go terribly wrong. But oftentimes, they're able to de-escalate situations. And sometimes with a little bit of creativity and humor. Here's Daniel Feltz describing how they got a homeless man out of a convenience store who was trespassing with a simple snack.
He was super intoxicated and had been at the location for a while, and the folks there were wanting him trespassed. So Kimber asked him what he needed from there, and he had come to get a honey bun. So Kimber was able to procure him a honey bun and then walk further and further away from the location, drawing him off the property far enough that we could give him the honey bun, and he was on his way without police contact.
So at 30, coordinators, organizers of CAHOOTS feel like they've really done a lot of good for the city of Eugene-Springfield. The city has increased their budget, so they're going to be increasing their coverage hours and being able to reach out to more people. And this also includes making visits to middle school and high schools to talk to kids about mental health awareness and mental health issues. So there's been a lot of positive outreach, and I think at 30, CAHOOTS is looking pretty strong.
When you call the police non-emergency line, if it's a mental health issue, they send CAHOOTS, right?
They do. Okay. There is an assessment. Okay. And usually I think most of the times they try to promote a non-emergency line if someone's, you know, having a case. But for a lot of people who may be in distress, they may not necessarily know to call that non-emergency number. So I think dispatch does kind of review and see if this is something that police should respond to. And it's a big difference when they arrive, because if police arrive, they're going to arrive in a car, a squad car with its flashing lights. There's going to be uniformed police with guns, body cameras, body armor, a very imposing figure. And then if it's CAHOOTS, their appearance is more casual. They don't have the flashing lights, and they're there right away to kind of lessen the tension, lessen the pressure of whatever situation someone would be having. So it's not that the police don't have a job to do. It's just that sometimes just the mere arrival and appearance can really set the stage for what's about to transpire.
As someone who's worked downtown, obviously at KLCC, and then before this in the food industry, we had a restaurant, and we had to call CAHOOTS in that context several times, and also in this current context of my job now. And I have always been so impressed with how professional and respectful and quickly they respond. And I think what's interesting is they're unusual. Like they were on the national news a lot in the past year or two, mm-hmm. and I don't think we're used to seeing their vans around and hearing about CAHOOTS. But in most other cities, when you call the police about a mental health issue, the police show up, like you said, and it can be intimidating to the person who's having the episode. And so it is a really unique program that obviously is doing an important thing.
I think one of the biggest splashes they got was the Wall Street Journal article that came out in October, because that's when the inquiries began pouring in from places like Portland, Roseburg, Oakland, California, Victoria, B.C. New York City has a mental health advocacy group that really wants to implement this model. So there is a lot of interest now, and a lot of people basically calling up CAHOOTS and saying, how do you do this? And it's funny, when I talked to one of the people in my story, Kimberly Robles Reyes, she's grown up in the Whitaker neighborhood. And so for her, the idea of a city that does not have CAHOOTS is kind of an alien concept. They've been around that long that we have a generation of people who've grown up knowing nothing else.
Right.
So the idea that other cities don't have this model is kind of shocking to some.
Yeah, agreed.
And you can find Brian's stories at our website, klcc.org.
I'm going to go listen, actually, because I was on vacation.
So, Chris, the legislature finally wrapped up its session on June 30th, on the last day at the last minute. How are things in Salem now?
Well, for the most part, things have quieted down significantly. You don't have the buzz of 90 lawmakers in the building every day, as was the case for the previous 5 months. Now, there's still a few things going on worth paying attention to as far as the legislative session. Number one is that the governor, Kate Brown, is still deciding whether to sign a good chunk of the bills that the legislature passed. She signed hundreds of bills already, but she has another 3 or 4 weeks to make up her mind on the remaining bills, and that is whether she'll sign or veto those bills. Normally, she signs all of the bills because the Democrats control the House and the Senate, and Brown is herself a Democrat, so there isn't quite the dynamic of one party trying to pass a bill that the governor of another party doesn't like. But, you know, nevertheless, she may take some issue with parts of bills and so forth. So we'll keep an eye out for that in the coming weeks. There's some ongoing fallout over the walkout by the 11 Republican senators that put the brakes on a massive carbon emissions regulation bill, or at least contributed to that, depending on who you ask. But certainly there's been some personal and political fallout from that, that lawmakers are still trying to sort out. What is that going to mean when they return to Salem next time? And, you know, I emailed back and forth a little bit with Senator Floyd Przanski of Eugene this week, asking him about a comment he made in a recent newsletter saying that there could be legislation in the next legislative session that would attempt to change the rules regarding what constitutes a quorum. Right now, you need 2/3 of the legislators in either the House or the Senate to have a quorum and therefore conduct business. So obviously, as we saw last month, that quorum can be denied if one caucus decides to leave. So Senator Przanski told me some folks are talking about advancing legislation to make a quorum perhaps a simple majority. Now, that's somewhat inside baseball. It's very technical in a way, but it also can affect hundreds of bills, you know, whether they get passed or not, as we saw recently. So it's something to keep an eye out. Nothing definite that we know at this point. Of course, another thing that lawmakers are watching right now will be whether or not the what's called the Student Success Act, also known as the corporate tax hike to fund education, that's House Bill 3427, whether that is successfully referred to the ballot by folks who are gathering signatures right now. They have another couple of months to get the signatures that would be needed to force a vote on that. If the vote happens, it would take place in January, late January, as a special election that would have potentially a dramatic impact on what lawmakers do during the February session next year, because if that Student Success Act is overturned by voters, that will leave a big hole in the education budget that they'll need to either fill in some other way or inform school districts that they won't be getting nearly as much money as they were counting on for the current budget cycle. So these are all things that are going on in some cases behind the scenes, in some cases in neighborhoods near you as people gather signatures. But just because lawmakers are no longer in Salem at the Capitol doesn't mean, of course, that politics has ground to a halt in Oregon.
So I feel like we can't mention the end of the legislative session without mentioning our State Senator Brian Boquist, who is now, let's see, I want to make sure I get this right. After making threatening remarks before the second walkout, and this is the walkout about the cap and trade bill that you mentioned, Chris, he made some threatening remarks. And now, according to a Senate committee deciding this on Monday, he must give 12 hours written notice before entering the Capitol in the near future, because he basically told police, the police that you send after me better be unmarried.
And heavily armed.
And heavily armed,
yeah.
Yes. So now it's kind of, I feel like he got a little bit of a note from the principal's office. There's a little bit of a, you know, wag of the finger and said, you've got to let us know before you come to the Capitol so that we can have extra officers around. It's kind of a crazy thing.
But. Certainly not a friendly connotation with those remarks.
No.
Now, and it's interesting, too, because there is no enforcement mechanism to that other than holding an additional hearing by the conduct committee to come up with additional punishments. So it's not as though if Senator Boquist walks into the Capitol building with no advance notice, he's not going to be arrested or fined in any way. They'll just sort of have to reconvene their committee and say, well, I guess he's not following our instructions. Another practical thing, I mean, 12 hours advance notice in writing, and it was clarified that in writing can be an email. So, he could email the Secretary of the Senate at 7 p.m. One evening and say, I'm going to be in the Capitol at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning. And that would technically meet the 12-hour requirement. But, I mean, what's really going to happen in the overnight hours? And, I mean, you know, so it's partly symbolic, partly, and symbolism is important, of course, but whether it makes any sort of practical difference to the way people use the Capitol building in the near future is really unclear to me.
It's kind of like the Senate equivalent of getting detention or something like that. You know, it's light. It's
very light. It's
a very light warning.
I think it's closer to the wagging of
the
finger,
I think you're
actually.
Right. Maybe not even detention. Yeah, exactly. It's just a little mark on his record.
Frowny face on his report card.
Right. Exactly.
You are listening to the Northwest Passage, KLCC's weekly podcast. I'm Rachel McDonald with Ani Katz, Brian Bull, and Chris Lehman. And it's time for us to hopefully come have some cheerful news to wrap this up. And I'm going to start, actually, because it turns out a lot of well-known local institutions and not-so-local institutions got started in the year 1969. The Oregon Country Fair is this weekend, and it's 50 years old this year. KLCC's Tiffany Eckert found out a little more about its early years and visited the Lane County History Museum, where there's lots of memorabilia on display.
Faith Kresge is exhibits curator.
The very first fair was the Oregon Renaissance Pleasure Fair, and it was held in November 1969. And it was actually held in an abandoned peach orchard off of Hocken Lane.
Some of the most treasured items in the archives are photographs of the first fair taken by Eugene resident Harry Gross.
And the other thing that's 50 years old this year is Jazzercise. I visited Eugene Jazzercise and spoke with Nadia Barrett, who's been doing Jazzercise for more than 40 years. She attends classes every day, sometimes three times a day.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Well, I love Jazzercise. I was an instructor for over 20 years, and I tried other programs throughout the years, but Jazzercise is the best. It's a full fitness. You work every part of your body.
I want to be retired and go to class three times a day. That's
Jazzercise addiction. Play. By the way, I'm 50 this year.
Aww.
Yeah, see, lots of great things happen that year.
Jazzercise, Oregon Country Fair, Brian Bull.
It's all on the same level.
I feel so honored.
Well, my special story of the week is actually no story. I took a full 2 weeks off of listening to the news, and I have to say it was a very healthy experience. It was amazing to see how much news hadn't changed when I tuned back in. It was like, oh, we're still talking about Iran. We're still talking about the end of the legislative session in Oregon. So that was nice to see, but it also felt. It felt good to take 2 weeks off of the news, of listening. So a reminder, as you head off on your summer vacations, try to tune out. If you can't do a full 2 weeks, try to tune out for like a long weekend at least. It'll do your brain a favor. Maybe listen to KLCC's excellent music program. So don't turn the radio off.
Shout out.
Good therapy there.
Yeah.
I just have a couple really quick ones, and they actually kind of touch base with what we've already talked about. There had been made mention of Jazzercise, which made me think of leg warmers, and those scenes are actually apparent in Stranger Things Season 3, which is the blockbuster Netflix series. And just this morning, I caught an article that said that Stranger Things Season 3 has broken a number of records. 41 million households have watched Season 3 since it rolled out, I believe, on the 4th of July. And 18 million households have already downloaded and binge-watched all 8 episodes. So they're ready for season 4 whenever they get around to it. And I think there will be easily a season 4, just given the big outpouring of interest in the series of the paranormal happenings around Hawkins, Indiana. I won't give too much away, but if there's any kind of echo effect here, we talk about things kind of sounding familiar again. I grew up in the 80s, so there's a lot of happenings at this mall that happens there called the Star Court Mall. I see the Gap. I see tons of people walking around in jellies and stirrup pants.
Oh my God.
Don't really realize, growing up in that era, how iconic your generation's look was. And I was like, oh my God, that is totally 80s, the hair, everything. But there's also a little hint of, actually a very strong hint of Russian interference right there in the opening scene of the first episode. So make of that what you will. The Russians still have a very strong interest in what's happening here overseas in America. Lastly, Volkswagen has discontinued production of its iconic Bug. They started off very early on with a very dark root, if you will. Hitler endorsed them. They translate to the people's car. And so Hitler, seeing what the Model T did for America, wanted to have a similar vehicle for the German people. So there's actually photos of him endorsing Volkswagen Bugs at a podium. But that later got transitioned to a more kind of a free spirit, thinking small, conservation-minded vehicle in the 60s, and it really took off with hippies and flower children. And we also remember the big rash of Herbie movies that Disney put out. So
right.
That's a kind of a nice rebranding, if you will. But for a lot of people who love the Bugs, they're going away.
Chris, anything from you?
Sure. Well, now you can show your support for the environment as you drive your greenhouse gas-emitting vehicle around town. The Oregon DMV announced this week that you can, starting in August, you can get a Keep Oregon Green license plate. It's a new design for the state that features a forest in the background and a large photo, or not photo, a drawing of a Smokey Bear, who is apparently celebrating his 75th birthday this year. So love him while you can. He won't be around forever. And the interesting thing about this is that if you've always wanted a license plate with a very low number on it, you can do that, but not by luck, but by bidding. The organization Keep Oregon Green that is sponsoring these plates is actually auctioning off the right to get low license plate numbers on eBay. Currently, as I speak, there is an auction underway for plate number 00004. And believe it or not, as we're recording this, there's about 4 days left on this auction. Believe it or not, the current bid is $1,025.
Just to scream, I'm number four.
Yeah, to be number four, yes. So anyway, if you've always wanted that, then get your credit card out, I guess.
I mean, that's a smart fundraising idea.
Hey, whatever works, you know?
Yeah, I guess. Go number four.
Go number four.
Well, thanks to everyone for listening to the Northwest Passage. I'm Rachel McDonald, KLCC News Director.
I'm Ani Katz, host of Morning Edition.
I'm Brian Bull, news reporter.
And I'm news reporter Chris Lehman.